And so Dustin talked about nature, and Steve last week talked about music, and I'm talking about books this week, and then next week Blaine Rings is going to talk about movies, and then we'll be in Vision Sunday. And then just so you know, trajectory-wise, then after Vision Sunday, we're going into 1st and 2nd Peter, and the worship leaders and some of us that teach got together yesterday to talk through 1st and 2nd Peter, and I think the general consensus is we're not super excited about it. It says things that seem hard to us that we don't frankly want to hear. So that's going to be fun. That's what a promo, huh? I'm such a positive guy. And so that's where we're going to go. But I want to just, as I go into this morning, the reason that we're doing this series is there's a specific line of thought. And the thought is this, is that if we were truly created in the image of God, and if when our first father and mother sinned, if the image of God didn't get erased in us but was only cracked, then everybody still carries the image. And so even when an artist who may or may not love God, even when a musician, an author, a director, an actor, even though they may not even understand why, that they reflect the image of God sometimes. That nobody has everything wrong, that nobody is completely desolate, that everybody, there's a spark somewhere. And so we did basically this same series either last summer or the year before. I think it was the year before. And we called it Imago Dei Leaks, because that's the idea we're after, is that if we all have the image of God in us, then Imago Dei leaks. The image of God leaks into art, and especially into art. And we find it in all these places. And so Steve can stand up here last week and take songs that weren't written about God, and he can talk about how those songs somehow reflect something about God to him. And so this morning, I'm going to do that with Stephen King. I'm going to talk about how Stephen King reflects the image of God, and I will venture to bet that doesn't get said in church a lot, but we're going to get there. So that's what we're doing with this. I want to talk about, I love fiction, all right? And I'm just going to admit that up front, all right? When I was a kid, I liked to read, and I liked to read a lot, and Glassford, we had one little library that was about maybe a quarter the size of this room, a one-room library. It was that small. And I would ride my bike up to there, and I don't know what else they had in the library, but the most important thing is they had the complete works of Franklin W. Dixon, the collected works, also known as the Hardy Boys, all right? And so I think back then it was up to like 110 books. By the way, once you've read one Hardy Boy book, you've read them all right? Hey, big secret. At the end, the case the kids are working on, it's the same case their dad, the international spy, is also working on. It always works out that way. All right? So the rule at the library was that we could only check out 6 books at a time. So, yeah. So I would go get my 6 books, balance them on my handlebars, go home, and I could blow through a Hardy Boy book about one a day in the summers. This is before cable television in Glassford. I know, dark ages. Before iPods and those things, and when my mom believed in the mantra, go outside and play. And taking a book outside and laying on the front porch reading counted to her. She didn't care what we did as long as we weren't in the house. That's all she cared about. I recognize that now. And so I spent my childhood reading, and I moved on beyond Hardy Boy books to reading everything I could get my hands on. Yes, I've read Anne of Green Gables, at least the first 2 or 3 books, because why? It was there, and I needed something to read. So ferocious appetite for reading, and I'm still like that. I read every year close to about 50 books, and most years when I tally at the end of the year, almost 20 of those are novels. Some of them I'm proud of. Some I'm ashamed to admit that I've read. Anything by Nicholas Sparks. So, but when I got into ministry, I had these awkward conversations with other pastors sometimes where they talked about, like, what do you like to read? And I would, you know, of course, you know, I like to read, you know, what theologian do you like? Yes, I like to read the collected works of Karl Barth. All 5 volumes of Church Dogmatics, of course. That's what I read all the time. But I would get honest and say, you know, I'm reading a good book I finished one this week by Anne Quinlan, and I love Anne Quinlan. And I might say that. And I would get these strange looks from other pastors. And I would say, do you read fiction? And they would wrinkle up their nose like, no, like, why would I waste my time with such foolishness? I only read theologians. And I think that's true of a lot of people. And it's not true of me. I really love fiction. And so when I decided we were going to do this series a long time ago, hi, big eyes right here. When I decided to do the series a long time ago, I thought, I really want to talk about fiction, because I don't know if I've ever here talked about how much I love fiction and why I love fiction. And then there was a book this summer that really kind of exploded, and I'll get to that one here in a little bit. But I want to set up why I like fiction. I thought I'd start. This is from Shauna Nyquist's blog. You already saw her. It was a long time ago, but I remembered it, and so I pulled it down this week. She says this: lately, though, I've been having more and more conversations with people who don't read fiction at all, who don't value it, or who regard it as nothing more than escapism, a guilty pleasure. I find that Christians especially read with a very practical, utilitarian mindset. Typically, they regard fiction as fun reading, but read theology or Christian living books to be instructed. Or if they read fiction, it has to be allegory. Lewis Tolkien, Buchner. My Christian friends generally love film. They respect story in that format, but very few of them love fiction. I don't understand it. So before I launch out and talk about why I love fiction and talk about the book I'm going to talk about, just curious, real quick, how many of you would say you're lovers of fiction, all right? Wow, that's a lot. That's good. Some of you now feel like you're in the minority, John. So I'm just curious, best read you've read in the last month? The Expected One. What else? Nothing good in the last month. Yeah. 11/22/63 by Stephen King. Yes. Interesting. Yes. Game of Thrones. Return of the King. Return of the King. Tolkien. What else? Fahrenheit 51. 451. I've always wanted to read that, and I never have. Kite Runner, and then the sequel. Have you ever heard the sequel, Under a Thousand Splendid Suns? Yes, you must. If you like Kite Runner, I think it's better. It's beautiful. Yeah, sorry, that one of my favorite books ever. Oh, beautiful. Anybody else? Yeah, Jen. The Bone Season. And yeah, that's the one you put on my Facebook this week. And eagerly anticipating the new Stephen King in a month, right? The Doctor what? Doctor Sleep. Yes, that's it. Awesome. Anybody else? Dawn Treader. Oh, yes. Those were also, when I was a kid, those, once a year, I'd read The Chronicles of Narnia. And a couple years ago, I was like, I'm going to do that again. I think it took me 3 nights. Just, they're fast and good. All right? So why is this true? Or at least it's true for me. Has anybody else run into this before, that when you tell serious Christian people that you like fiction, that they wrinkle up their nose and kind of, why is that true? Why do Christians seem to love film so much, and yet we look at books as kind of like, Okay, a story is seen as elementary. And people do that with Jesus even. Like, Jesus just told stories. Paul was serious. And that's why in many churches, we talk so much about Paul and so little about Jesus. It's because Jesus just told little stories with flannel graph. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Some of us just get in ruts. Yeah. Yeah. Some of us just get in a rut and we don't think about it. Joe. Oh, so they're always measuring it against the Bible. So there's the Bible and then books, and they always fall short. Okay? Wow, lots of hands. Here. Whoa! All right, hold on. Sheila was told in high school that Christian romance novels were like Christian pornography. All right? Wow. I'm trying to wrap pornography. Don't. Stop. Please stop what you're doing. Yeah. Yeah, so maybe it's the way we approach things. As often we look at literature as reading or as education, movies as entertainment. But what we're talking about in great novels is the overlap of those, that it's entertaining. When you read Moby Dick, it's entertaining, but it's also something to learn. You know, like in great literature, there's that two things are happening. I'm going to talk about that in just a minute. Oh, so they would say, basically saying that the acknowledgement that movie is a more powerful medium, and so be afraid of movies, only read books. I don't think that's always true. I like Joey Tribbiani, I did have to put The Shining in the freezer at one point, you know, because it's, you know, which is, by the way, I'll give you the intro to Stephen King in a minute. That's how I started reading Stephen King, so I'm like, if Joey has to put it in the freezer, I'm reading it. Yeah, so movies come with a handy rating guide, and you can go online and get a little, you know, and books are much harder. Wow, lots of hands. I'm going to go back here. I've hit this section really hard. Becky, and then I'm going to this side, all right? The time commitment, yes. Yeah. Yeah, even though it takes you like 12 hours to watch The Lord of the Rings, way faster than all the books, you know? Yeah, I'm going to get to that. I'm going to hold that aside. Becky just says a book gets into you, and I'm going to talk about that in a minute because I think that's important, all right? One more over here.
People get
T-shaped, right? Yeah. Let's hope not. Yeah, right. Well, yeah, we do that. We oftentimes we do that, and we do that with movies too, that we take one thing and we make it representative of the whole. And that's a good transition into one of the things we have to understand as we work through this series is what we're not saying is that we should just go out wholesale and everything, grab everything. Because sometimes the spiritual, the imago Dei that leaks is so faint and there's so much other stuff you have to wade through that it's just not worth it. And I think we do that in some areas. Like we can make distinctions in our head between things that are thoughtful and have something to say and things that really have nothing to say, right? There's a difference here, right? There's a different way that we watch these. Please nod yes. All right, thank you. And if you haven't seen 42, I've seen it twice now. I saw it in theater and again. Oh, it's so good. Steve apparently told us that one of these isn't even music. So clearly the Imago Dei is not in Psy in any way, shape, or form. Is it, according to Steve, that's what I think he said last week. And then when you get to novels, I'll give you an example for me. Two books I read on spring break last year. This shows how varied my reading is, by the way. My spring break reading list included these two books. On the right, I'll start on the right, is World War Z. Here's what it has in common with the movie. It's called World War Z. That is, if any of you, besides, I know Ryan and I have both read this. It really has nothing to do with anything. And it's fine. There's nothing wrong with reading about zombie apocalypse. And laying on a beach, I would argue it's probably the right thing to be reading when you're laying on a beach and dozing off. And then I read at the same time Anna Quinlan's book, Every Last One, which is maybe one of my favorite books from Anna Quinlan. And like tears in my eyes. And something deep called the deep somehow. Like Steve talked about last week, that as I was reading this novel, something stirred in me deep. And I'll just give you the tease for the book, and I can't tell you much because it'll ruin the book, but it's about how everyday decisions have consequences, how things that we don't think matter, that we make decisions about and don't talk about or don't address, how those things can sometimes come back and bite you in the butt. And it's just, she writes beautifully, and so I read those in very, very different ways. And so we understand, right, that there's different, even when we start talking about fiction, there's a difference between 50 Shades of Grey and Anna Quinlan, right? There's, again, yes, there's a difference, all right? So here's what I love. In a nutshell, here's what I love, is that good fiction tells the truth in a more comprehensive way than nonfiction. That I can get up here and tell you truths. But somehow, when I'm in the world of fiction, here's what Becky said, is I have to live in that character. And I have to live in those characters. And I have to live in that place and in that time. And I can understand truth, to me, in a more comprehensive way, in a more nuanced way, that I see how it's actually lived out. Because preachers can get up and give you platitudes all day long, but then when we talk about what does that actually mean to live, it gets more dicey, right? And so three ways I think that happens. First of all, good fiction is holistic. It covers all of life. It covers everything. And so when we read, to me, great fiction has good and evil. And it handles those things in a very nuanced way. And I add that here at the end. These are in terrible order. Good fiction lets me see the world through someone else's eyes, and it's nuanced. So when I read good fiction, I'm transported to time and place and people that I don't even know and I don't even understand, and I get to see their world through their eyes, even if that world is crazy, all right? Even if that world is Harry Potter. And I mean, seriously, how many of us haven't wished that we could go play Quidditch, right? Like, okay, I'm the only one. Dang. I like these revealing statements, and then I find out that I'm the only freak show here. But this is why I love fiction. And I mean, the headline for me is that good fiction tells the truth. Sorry, Shanna. I thought of Shanna, especially when I put that up there. But good fiction tells the truth about life. And even when, like what we're going to talk about, it's a farcical situation that a giant dome drops on a town, somehow good fiction tells the truth about the characters, and the characters are true. Have you ever had that point, I don't know if you've been reading a novel or watching a movie or anything, where a character does something that's so out of character that you're like, oh, this is dumb. Like, this was going this way, and then this person, like, it doesn't make sense. That's not good fiction. Good fiction is where we see, like, I'll tell you, when I read The Shining for the first time, one of the things this got me in The Shining is you see the slow deterioration of Jack Torrance. If those of you that have read The Shining, you get the slow deterioration of Jack Torrance, and you see this character unraveling in his head, and it's scary. It's freezer scary. And so it's good fiction to me just tells the truth in ways that are hard to tell in other forms. All right? Is that fair? One last personal note. This is the pastor note, right? I just wanted to read this to you because it's so rich to me. This is from Frederick Buechner, who wrote a book called Telling the Truth. And he's talking mostly to pastors about the act of preaching and that kind of thing. And he says this. He's also a novelist, but he says this. So if preachers or lecturers are to say anything that really matters to anyone, including themselves, they must say it not just to the public part of us that considers interesting thoughts about the gospel and how to preach it, but to the private inner part too. Let me stop there. What he's saying is that I can get up and I can be intelligent and tell you what the history of this is and the theology of this is, and we can all walk away going, those are very good ideas to discuss today. But he's saying good preaching moves beyond those big ideas and gets to the inner parts of us too, to the part of us where all our dreams come from, both our good dreams and our bad dreams, the inner part where thoughts mean less than images, elucidation less than evocation, where our concern is less with how the gospel is to be preached than with what the gospel is and what it is to us. They, meaning the preacher, must address themselves to the fullness of who we are and to the emptiness too. I love that. To the fullness of who we are and to the emptiness too, the emptiness where grace and peace belong, but mostly are not, because terrible as well as wonderful things have happened to us all. Amen? The preacher must always try to feel what it is like to live inside the skins of the people he is preaching to hear the truth as they hear it. That is not as hard as it sounds, because of course he is himself a hearer of the truth as well as a teller of the truth, and he listens out of the same emptiness as they do for a truth to fill him and make him true. One of the reasons I read fiction is because if I stand up here and talk every week just about my own experience, I've experienced like this much of life. And all of us have these slivers of life. And I think that when I read fiction, it opens me up to other slivers of other people's lives, and you begin to see the emptiness that's in all of us. And to me, that's the heart of that. That's my spiritual justification for fiction, is that fiction opens my eyes. And I will tell you this, if I were out looking for a church and I met with a pastor and said to him, do you read fiction? And he said, no, I may not go to his church, because I think it's that important for understanding a fuller picture of the church, of the truth. Because more than anything, more than a smart preacher or a good speaker, I want somebody who will speak truth, even when it's about emptiness and darkness. Even if he hasn't gone into those places, that he's listened and he's tried to see the world through the eyes of everybody else. So, important enough, all right? That's for me. All right. Well, here we are. I wasn't kidding. I've obviously heard of Stephen King my whole life. His first book, I think, was written the year I was born. I think Carrie was written in 1974. Mostly afraid of him. I have a very active imagination. I would argue, Dallas Ann, with your upbringing, that because of my imagination, oftentimes books are much more powerful to me than movies. Movies cheapen it. I can't now read Harry Potter without thinking of the characters from the movie inserted. They somehow wormed their way into my imagination, and it ticks me off because mine was just better. And that's true for all of us. If you read fiction well, the world you create in your head will almost always be better than the world they can put on screen, because they're limited and I'm not. And so I was afraid of him, honestly, because I have an active imagination. There was a book, I was telling some friends last night, there was a book I read several years ago. There's almost every book I start, I finish, and especially novels. There's one that maybe someday I'm going to go try back to finish, but there's this novel that I started several years ago by Dean Koontz. I don't know if any of you read Dean Koontz. I had to quit halfway through because I couldn't sleep. Like I would finish reading for the night, and usually I read myself to sleep, but this one, I would start to doze off, and then I'd be like, eyes wide, like I cannot, and then I'd try to put it down, and then I'd just lay there. Like every sound in my house freaked me out. And so it's the one book I quit. And so I've been afraid of him for a very long time. I'm not kidding, when Joey put Shining in the freezer, I had to figure out what it was all about. So I read The Shining, and I was like, okay, I can handle that. Don't read it late at night. And since then, here's my reading list. I think he's written somewhere, I saw a thing that said like 50-some novels. And some of them are under pen names, some of them with other people. I have read 7. I've read The Shining, The Stand, and then most of my stuff is newer. So Hearts in Atlantis, Dreamcatcher, Duma Key, Under the Dome, and then 11/22/63. Those are the ones I've read. And so there's others on my list that I will work through someday. But I got through The Stand. So if you can get through The Stand, I feel like you've accomplished something. All right, it's yeah. And then one other book of his that I'm going to refer to later is a book that he wrote. It's not a novel, but he wrote a book on the process of writing. And I actually read his book on writing before I had read any of his novels. I should have said that the other way. I read his first novel, The Shining, after hearing that. I read the book on writing long before that. And I fell in love with some of his process and how he thinks about books. And I'm going to point at some of that in a minute. Because I just like the way he goes about developing things. So that's my biography. That's Stephen King. So last year or so, I picked this book because it's popular this summer. How many of you are watching the television show? I'm the only one. All right, like 4 of us, 5 of us. It's a really popular TV show. Well, dang it. So this got made into a TV show. Again, like the zombie movie, you know what it shares with the book? Pretty much the title. And a dome. That's about all it shares with the book. Like I see when I watch the TV show, like, oh, I see where they got that idea and took it out of the book. I was going to, like, it just, yeah, it's not the same thing. I'm not going to spoil anything. I don't know how to spoil the TV show for you because I have no idea what they're doing with the thing. They've kind of created their own thing, and Stephen King has blessed it. It's an interesting idea. Stephen King tried to write this book in the 70s, he said. He wrote a manuscript, and he got a couple hundred pages into the manuscript, and then he quit because he just got stuck. Sometimes when you all know this, when you're painting or when you're writing a song or when you're cooking, there's times where you're working on something and developing something, and you just get stuck. He got stuck, and he put it in a drawer and was done with it. In the 80s, he picked it up again and started working on it again, and he got stuck again. But he really loved the seminal idea, and I'll get to that in a second. But then finally, just a couple years ago, he recruited a team of people to work with him to deal with like the science and the ecology of if this really happened, so to feel like he could really do it well. And so he did it, and now it's on NBC. No plug for NBC, although they need all the plugs they can get. So here's a quick summary. There's a town, and it's called Chester's Mill. King sets almost all his novels in Maine because he's from Maine. And I have friends that have actually lived close to him and like run by his house. And they see him out walking because he walks every afternoon. He goes on a walk, which is how he got hit by a car several years ago. Not a great plug for walking. So Salem comes up over and over again. I'm going to keep looking at Jen and Ryan because, Ryan, you've read almost everything, right? All 50? Yeah. So you are my experts. So if I'm off, you just. Chester's Mill is this sleepy Maine town, blah, blah, blah. You don't go find out a lot about Chester's Mill in the beginning, but it's the central character as the book goes on. And one day, out of nowhere, a dome drops on this town. All right? It just. Like, you know, like the serving dishes in fancy restaurants where they carry it and there's like that dome thing, whatever you call that, like that just drops on the town. Nobody can get in or out. Water can just barely pass through. There's rules of the dome. We'll fly through later, but there's rules. Water, I'm just going to go off the book and not the television. Water can kind of barely get through. Like if you spray a hose hard at it, the inside of the dome will get wet. You can talk through the dome. They can get Wi-Fi. They can get radio signals, and they can talk to people on the outside. This is not true in the television show, but in the book, they can communicate, but they're stuck in the dome. And then the army, of course, then clears everybody out so they don't get to and shuts down their phones and everything else so they don't get to communicate. So they're isolated in their town. And the book really goes, if I remember the timeline right, it's about a week from the dome dropping to just the disaster in the end. All right, the movie, the TV show is stretching it way out, but it's about a week. So Chester's Mill is the main character, this little town. So I just want you to imagine, like, the thought is very intriguing, right? And this is why King loved this idea. Like, pretend that right now a dome dropped over the sanctuary, and these are the people that we have to deal with now, all right? With food running scarce and water a problem and the air being slowly polluted, these are the people we have to deal with. And some of us would arise as leaders, and some of us would start an insurrection, and some of us would... Yeah. Now you're all thinking, right? Do you ever play this game, by the way? Sometimes I sit like in a waiting room and I pretend, like if a dome dropped here. That guy would be a problem. Does anybody else do that? Yes, good. Yes, man, thank you. Yes. I do that all the time. So you understand how this is really interesting. When you put people in a pressure situation and then wind them up and then say, what happens then? It's an intriguing idea. And you could even, if you just like to write, take 8 of your friends and drop a dome on them and see what happens. And it might be really fun and really disturbing. The dome is obviously then the major character. It keeps everything in one spot. So even if you think about it, like if a dome dropped today, I would be without my wife and kids. And some of you would too, because your spouse wasn't able to make it today. And things would be undone on the outside, but you're stuck here. And things that had already started happening, we'll see in a minute, are in place. So obviously, very character-driven. It's about the characters. I'm going to point at two characters because we're going to refer to them later. The one is Big Jim Rennie. Big Jim is the second councilman who really acts like the first councilman. The king describes him as the guy who wants to be second, so he never gets blamed when things go wrong, but he's always pulling the strings. And so when the dome drops, we find out that Big Jim is really quite evil, and the book progresses. He gets more and more evil. He is the evil guy. He's the bad guy. And he's trying to take people's stuff away and manipulate people and control things, and he creates a militia out of teenagers, which is always a bad idea. But he can control them. And so that's Big Jim, and we're going to talk about Big Jim in a minute. And then the protagonist on the other side is a guy named Dale Barbara, known as Barbie, and he's an ex-Marine who was actually just passing through Chester's Mill and had gotten into a little trouble in the town, had been there for a little while working as a short order cook, had gotten in a scrape with Big Jim's son, and was actually on his way out of the town the day the dome dropped. He was walking out. By the way, when the dome drops, some of you that are engineer types, just think about how fun this is, right? On TV, in the book it's a woodchuck, but on TV it was a cow that the dome just dropped right in the middle of the cow. All right, so if you've been watching the previews at all, it's awesome. Just sliced, all right? And then, like, there's a plane that just crashes into it because they don't see it. You can't see it. I backed up to the dome there. It was exciting. And so Dale Barbara is the guy that comes to symbolize the resistance to Big Jim Rennie. And so it's this really clear, and we're going to talk about this in a minute, this really clear depiction of there's good and there's evil and how the two play out with each other. And then the other big character in the book, the last big character, is Propane. Not just a clean source of fuel, but also the way that you make meth, apparently. And so what's going on that you find out pretty quickly is Big Jim Rennie is running a deal in the town where he's using town funds to work his methamphetamine lab that's based in a church. And the king has these little jabs at religion all the time, right? So there's a pastor, and I'm going to talk about this pastor in a minute, who it's the pastor, Big Jim, and the head of the police that are in on this, and a couple others, that they are running the biggest meth lab in the United States. And they're diverting town funds and hoarding all the propane to run the meth lab, and then they're shipping it all over the world. And they have bank accounts set up everywhere, and you find out throughout the book, you find out pretty early, I'm not ruining much, that they have got this huge enterprise and they're sitting on millions, and they were in the process of thinking about unwinding it all and shutting it all down because they had all made so much money and just diverting town funds, and there's a lot of stuff going on with that, all right? So imagine a town. Imagine this scenario. So you've got this dome drops and you've got these things going on and you've got interpersonal relationships, and then you get a 600-page novel talking about how that unpacks, okay? I'm not going to spoil it. I don't want to spoil it for you in case you want to read it. I do want to say one thing, though. I should have said this when I was introducing King. this is one of those places. I know that some of you on Facebook were having this discussion this week about, you know, like about holiness and what things in the culture do we accept and not accept. And I think that's something as Christians we always have to wrestle with, all right? And we have to decide, is what is redemptive in this? Is it worth some of the junk you have to wade through to get there, or is it not? And for all of us, that's a decision that we make almost movie to movie, book to book. There's books that I just won't read because it's just too much stuff to wade through to try to find where Imago Dei leaks in this. It's just not, it's not for me. And there's other things where I don't. And we all make those decisions about things, and we should be having those conversations. They're good conversations to have. I want to say very clearly, Stephen King is very rated R, even in the reading, all right? And maybe more so in the reading than the a lot more so. Okay, let me just say that again. Stephen King is a lot rougher in the reading than he is in the movies. If you've seen the movies, usually they're TV miniseries and they've been cleaned for television. So just so you know that when you go into it. That's the rules of the dome from the TV show. We don't need to spend a lot of those. It's just, it's an interesting idea. And I love what King's doing with that. Here's what I want to go after, and I'm running out of time, but I want to go after a couple things real fast. Here's where I think the Imago Dei leaks through King, and through this book, and then not just through this book, but there's many others, and I've put others up on the screen as I know them, where this also comes up, is that one of the things that King is great about is the idea of putting people in situations to see what they do. In his book on writing, he describes his process as this. When he sits down to write a book, I was just talking to somebody who was more, I don't mean to be picking on these kinds of people, but, you know, the mathematician engineering types. Yeah, and this person was saying, if I ever wrote a book, I would write an outline, and then I would just, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And that is not how King writes at all. He describes himself as, the way he writes is he thinks, what if a dome dropped on a town? Let's see what happens. And so as he writes, he says he's in a process of discovering who the characters are. That if you're going to write true characters, you don't know when you start the project what's going to happen in the end. You just follow it where it goes, and you see where people go. And one of the things he's big on in his book on writing is, especially when you're writing fiction, kill the people you love. Like, don't be afraid to kill off the characters that you love, because if that's where the story goes, you follow the story there. You follow it. It's something that's out there. And I love that idea that truth is out there, that we're finding it. We're going after it. We're searching for it. In fact, a preview of 1 Peter, one of the things we were talking about yesterday in our discussion of 1 Peter was the idea that the prophets were, what was the words there? Searching and, do you remember, like, what's that? Inquiring and searching after the truth. They were doing that. And I feel like when King's writing, one of the things he says in his book on writing is, like, that's what he's doing. He thinks of these crazy scenarios. There's lots of crazy scenarios in King. 11:22:63, a guy's going back in time. Cujo, a dog goes crazy. The Shining, there's a hotel that's really angry. And so, like, all these scenarios, but the idea is that you put people in the scenario. You put Jack Torrance in a hotel in Colorado, snowed in with a crazy, angry hotel, and you just see what happens. And I think that's really, I love that, because then what I talked about, seeing the truth and understanding people, you begin to see how people act, and you start seeing the truth of that. I want to give you one line, because I love this line in the book. He's talking about Big Jim Rennie, and he's talking about how this guy, he could leave the town at any point. He's made so much money off his meth lab, he could go somewhere else. But he says this about Big Jim, and when I read this, I remember reading this in the book, and I was just like, oh, that's so true. And he says this, it wasn't the money, it was the town. What he saw is his town. Sitting on a beach somewhere in Costa Rica or presiding over a guarded estate in Namibia, Big Jim would become Small Jim, because a man without a sense of purpose, even one whose bank accounts are stuffed with money, is always a small man. Oh, like, can you just think of people where you're like, yeah, that's true. Give somebody no purpose and they're small, and money just has nothing to do with it. So that's one of the things that I see in King, and that's across, I think, as far as I understand, even the ones I haven't read, that's every book of King. You create a situation, you create a scenario, and then you just let the characters speak truth. Let the characters be true to who they are, and you follow them through. The other thing that's really predominant in King is the idea of good versus evil. And I set this up, and you can go through all his books, I think, and it's pretty clear that there's a conflict between good and evil. That and King paints this in really clear ways, that there's usually you know who the good guys are and who the evil ones are. The Stand, for those of you who don't know, is how many pages? 1,200 pages in the Unabridged, which is the one I read. It's long, but it's really clear, and it's this choice between what's truly and clearly evil and what's truly good, and the war between the two. And you see that in the cover, by the way. I love it. This is the old cover from 1970, whatever he wrote it in, the cover between the guy in black and the guy in white fighting, and it's just such this clear contrast between what's good and evil. In this book, I mentioned the one we had the clear between Big Jim and Dale Barbara, that the conflict between the two major characters in good and evil, and I mentioned that. And then we have one of the plots going on is Big Jim wants to take away all, he takes away their guns and he takes away the food and he starts hoarding everything because he wants safety and he wants control. And then there's this conflict with, then what does it mean to be free people? And it's interesting that King is writing this post 9/11 where we're having a lot of those same discussions in our culture about what freedoms do we give up for the sake of safety. And so that's being played out as good and evil and what's freedom and what's control and really interesting dialogues. And I'm going quickly, but I need to. And then finally, I want to read just, it's a short chapter, but I want to read this chapter to you because I love this. One of the things King does over and over again is he contrasts many times true religion and shysters. So in this book, there's two pastors. Lester Coggins is the pastor of the flashy church. And the way King describes it, it's the church where they do the loud music and dancing in the aisles. And I'm not criticizing any tradition. It's just what he says. And it has billboards everywhere. And they're big, showy, flashy. That's Lester Coggins. Lester Coggins is his partner in the methamphetamine lab that's running in the church shed out back. And then there's Piper Libby. And I want you to hear how King describes Piper Libby. There were only two churches in Chester's Mill on Dome Day. Both pervade the Protestant brand of goods, although in very different ways. Catholics went to Our Lady of Serene Waters in Motton, next town over, and the town's dozen or so Jews attended Congregation Beth Shalom in Castle Rock when they felt in need of spiritual consolation. Once there had been a Unitarian church, but it died of neglect in the late 80s. Everyone agreed it had been sort of hippy-dippy anyway. The building now housed Mill New and Used Books. Both Chester's Mill pastors were what Big Jim Rennie liked to call knee-bound that night, but their modes of address, states of mind, and expectations were very different. The Reverend Piper Libby, who ministered to her flock from the pulpit of the First Congregational Church, no longer believed in God, although this was a fact she had not shared with her congregants. Lester Coggins, on the other hand, believed to the point of martyrdom or madness. Both words for the same thing, perhaps. The Reverend Libby, still wearing her Saturday grubs and still pretty enough, even at 45, to look good in them, knelt in front of the altar in almost total darkness, with Clover, her German shepherd, lying behind her with his nose on his paws and his eyes at half-mast. "Hello, not there," Piper said. Not there was her private name for God just lately. Earlier in the fall, it had been the great maybe. During the summer, it had been the omnipotent could be. She liked that one. It had a certain ring. "You know the situation I've been in. You should. I've bent your ear enough about it. But that's not what I'm here to talk about tonight, which is probably a relief to you." She sighed. "We're in a mess here, my friend. I hope you understand it, because I sure don't. But we both know this place is going to be full of people tomorrow looking for heavenly disaster assistance." It was quiet inside the church and quiet outside. Too quiet, as they said in the old movies. Had she ever heard the mill, Chester's Mill, this quiet on a Saturday night? There was no traffic, and the bass thump of whatever weekend band happened to be playing at Dippers, a bar, was absent. "I'm not going to ask that you show me your will, because I'm no longer convinced you actually have a will, but on the off chance that you are there after all, always a possibility, I'm more than happy to admit that. Please help me to say something helpful. Hope not in heaven, but right here on earth," because... She was not surprised to find that she had started to cry. She bawled so often now, though always in private. New Englanders strongly disapprove of public tears from ministers and politicians. Clover, sensing her distress, whined. Piper told him to hush, then turned back to the altar. She often thought of the cross there as a religious version of the Chevrolet bow tie, a logo that had come into being for no other reason than because some guy saw it on a wallpaper of a Paris hotel room 100 years ago and liked it. If you saw such symbols as divine, you were probably a lunatic. Nevertheless, she persevered. "Because, as I'm sure you know, earth is what we have, what we're sure of. I want to help my people. That's my job. I still want to do it. Assuming you're there, that you care, shaky assumptions I admit, then please help me. Amen." It's really interesting to me. I read that and I stopped reading and I thought about what King is trying to do with the showy upfront In the book, Lester Coggins is the guy that drops all the Christian cliches all the time. Praise Jesus, hallelujah, amen. And yet Piper Libby is the one who isn't sure if God is even there anymore, but is on her knees humbly praying to God. And she becomes a force for the good side, and she does good things, and she stands up in some really powerful ways for people that are being wronged. And you find this in King back and forth, this contrast between good and evil. The last thing I want to say, and then I'll close, is one of the things that you find in this book, and this really, I feel like Under the Dome is a mini version of The Stand. It's kind of The Stand done like in a week versus The Stand stretches out for a long time. But this idea that there's this real evil and it's growing, and there's this quote from Thomas Jefferson that, and I've shown it here before, all tyranny needs to gain a foothold is for people of good conscience to remain silent. And King goes into a section of the book where he talks about Nazi Germany and how people just stayed silent, and good people saw what Hitler was doing, and good people didn't want to rock the boat, and good people just kept their mouths shut, and then you get Hitler. And he compares that to the situation in the dome, that there's evil going on and there's bad things happening, and good people are sitting in their homes and not saying anything because they're afraid and they don't know what to say and they don't know what to do. And a big point of this book is when the people who are good finally get together and say, we've got to do something about this evil. We've got to speak to the evil. And that seems to be a really important theme for King, that evil is real in the world, and that evil really has consequences in the world, and that if good people won't speak to evil, then who's going to speak to evil? And when you don't speak to evil, it just gets more powerful, and that good people need to stand up and say something. All right? So here's the thing. So what? What we're trying to do in this series, I hope, is that you read differently. Listen to music differently. That maybe this week you listen to songs a little bit deeper because of what Steve said, and you heard things, and you went, oh, I see that. I hope that when you read, you don't just read for leisure. Yes, it is leisure. It's fun. It's entertainment. But that maybe along the way there's times where you stop in the book and you reflect and you go, when you read a prayer like that and you go, wow, that's true. I haven't prayed that exact prayer, but I've been close to those moments where, God, I don't know if you want to do anything about this. And it pierces us because Imago Dei leaks. I was preparing this, and I was thinking about that last point about silence and speaking to when we see evil. And so a couple weeks ago, I stood up here and told you all that I was getting ready to go on vacation on August 4th. And I've had several of you ask, and I've kind of blown off answers, but the truth is we never went on vacation. That night, we were supposed to leave here on a Monday morning, and we were going to drive to Colorado, and we were going to stay with our dear friends. And instead, we got a phone call at 11 o'clock that night from our dear friends to find out that their marriage is a mess. It's heartbreaking. And about every 4 days, I talked to him, or 3 days, and last night I talked to him for an hour or so, and then I laid in bed and stared out my window until 1:30 or something. And I told him, I saw some of these things. I saw some of the problems. And I rationalized it in my head. I told myself that, oh, this is just, you know, it's not really a big deal. It's just this thing, or it's just this, or, oh, I'm sure they're fine. It was just this thing. And I told him, like, I should have said something. I should have spoken to the things I saw that were not right. I should have spoken to evil when I saw evil, and I didn't. And at the end of the day, I'm not beating myself up. I'm just mostly, these tears are not because I'm beating me up. These tears are because I'm so sad for them. But what if? And I don't know if anything would have changed if I would have said, hey, you said this, you did this, what is happening with this thing over here? What's going on here? Because things don't seem right. And now I look back and it's so clear, like, oh man, all that stuff. So somehow, reading Stephen King reminds me that good people are supposed to stand up to evil, and we're supposed to have the courage to speak to evil, and especially when it's our good friends, we're supposed to say, I see this, and it's, I don't. and we don't have to be jerks about it, right? Like, so often in the Christian tradition, we talk about speaking truth to people in love, and really it's just our excuse to go be a jerk to somebody and tell them all the things we don't like about them. But when it's people that you really love, and they're really your friends, and we're all so nervous around each other, and mostly that nervousness is because I want people to like me, and I'm afraid if I speak truth to love in my friend's life, they're not going to like me anymore, and so I just let them go down paths of destruction. And I think what King is saying, holy cow, I'm quoting King in church as if it's the Bible, but what King is saying is when we see evil, if we don't speak to evil, evil grows, and good people, we're supposed to stand up to it, and we're supposed to name it, and we're supposed to pull it into the light, and we're supposed to call it what it is, so that then we can do something about it. Fair enough? That's why it matters.